How do you buy a house? Where do you go for advice from someone you can trust? And who looks out for your best interests? I'm Dan Ringer, and we'll talk about buying a house right now on The Law Works.
From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Closed captioning for The Law Works is made possible by a grant from the Monongalia County Bar Association to support legal information and education for all West Virginians. The Law Works is made possible by major grants from the Office of the West Virginia Attorney General and from Software Systems Incorporated, a West Virginia company established in 1975, which provides high-end support services, programming, and consulting for county government AS400 mid-range computer systems, as well as PC-based systems, and by a grant from the West Virginia Bar Foundation. The West Virginia Bar Foundation, the philanthropic organization for West Virginia's legal profession and justice system, promoting public knowledge of the law in West Virginia.
If you've ever bought a house, you were probably overwhelmed by what happened and couldn't have explained it. My guest is attorney Stephen Wicklund. Steve, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We talk about buying a house. You're a real estate attorney primarily.
Yes.
You've done a lot of, we call them closings, the actual transaction where the sale of the house and the purchase of the house is made. How many of those have you done over the years?
About 3,000.
So I would say you've seen everything, but then the next closing is always going to be different, so you haven't seen
everything. And they're more complicated now than they were 35 years ago.
Why is that?
First closing I had 4 sheets of paper. The last one had 110 sheets of paper.
And mostly that's because of government regulations to protect the people involved in the closing, and it just goes on and on.
It goes on and on and on.
One of the most important things to consider, let's say, for example, I want to buy a house. What should I start thinking about at the beginning?
Everyone preaches location, but you want to get a house that you're happy in. So you want to have it located where you want to be. In other words, location and happiness sort of go hand in hand. You want to be in the school district, you want to be in a safe area, you may want to be in the country, you may want to be in the city, but you've got to be someplace that you're happy. Every house has a price, and you want to make sure you can afford that house without putting a burden on your family or your livelihood. And the third thing you need to consider is what your bank is going to require, because sometimes you can find a house that you can afford that the bank will not give you the money that you can buy, even if you could afford it.
I've always thought that the first thought that should go through your mind is you're buying a house, you're not buying a home. And we talk about home buying and things like that. The house is not the home. The home is what you put into the house. The house is the machine that makes the home possible.
Right. And that's why people look at communities when they're looking at houses. And houses have a market value based on not the structure of the house, but on the community that they're in. You all have certain areas that will sell easier than others because they're in a better community. And that's very important for you to live in that community with the schools and the extras that you want in living, such as hospitals, such as shopping, such as friends that are in that same area. So you want to look at the community when you're looking at the house.
I don't know that anyone has ever done it. I've suggested to many people that they do it, but I've always thought that the best thing you can do, you find an area that you want to live in, you ought to go there at morning drive time. You ought to drive to it at evening drive time. You ought to drive around late at night to see what's going on. And honestly, you ought to go door to door, at least with the people immediately around you, and ask them how they like living there.
I came to Clarksburg area about 35 years ago, and I was not familiar with the area, even though I grew up in Weston and Morgantown, but I found that I had to be flexible. I looked at certain houses that I could afford. I looked at a better school district, but I chose to live in Bridgeport, even though it was, at that time, cheaper than Clarksburg. But I had to be flexible with what my income was and what I was looking for in the house. I found it worked fine. But you have to be flexible, but listen to the area.
Well, and areas change.
Right.
Just because you grew up in a town doesn't mean that it's the same town you're buying a house in when you come back maybe after school or after working somewhere
right.
else.
You've got to be comfortable in that area. If it's close to your work, has the extras that you want in the house, the home is secondary to the community.
Steve and I have known each other for a number of years, and I remember when you, well, you built your house, the one you're
second
living
house.
In now. Second house. You were in a fairly rural area part of Bridgeport. Now
it was outside of the city.
It was.
didn't have TV cable or anything, but cable was next door, so it looked like it was.
So long ago, they didn't have TVs. So,
right.
But things do change, and you have to make yourself familiar with them. And
areas change. You know, houses that were selling at a high price 10 or 20 years ago have now aged to the point that they need rehab. A new house is anything that's less than 20 years old, and it usually doesn't need much rehabbing. But if you get a house that's 20 to 30 to 40 years old, you're going to find replacements in a house, such as windows, roofs, kitchens, bathrooms, and those are expensive. So you've got to consider that when you're looking at the housing as well.
And if you're an old house fan and you want to buy a 100-year-old house, that stately mm-hmm. mansion that just looks wonderful,
have a deep pocket.
I bought one of those. go get the movie The Money Pit with Tom Hanks
right.
and watch that before you buy a really old house. But that raises another issue. I think I've got enough money to buy a house. I have a job. I've asked around and I've gone on the internet and I found out how much I can probably afford to pay as a mortgage payment on the house and a down payment on the house. I'm all set to go, except it's not that easy. There are other expenses.
Yeah. You know, first, you know, as you look at a closing, even with a bank, you're going to have $3,000 to $5,000 in closing costs, and you also have moving expenses and sometimes fix-up expenses. Even if it's a new house, you may have carpeting and painting that you want to match your furniture, so you have those expenses as well. So not only does the bank going to take $5,000, but your remodeling could take another $5,000. So it's expensive to move, even in the best of circumstances.
Well, I want to buy a house. I think I've got enough money. Who do I go to talk to find out if I can really afford to do this?
Most banks have pre-approvals, and those are the best thing that you can do is to go to your banker and talk what you can borrow, at what rate, how much of a down payment, what's required. They can generally give you an overview, and it's not definite that you're going to be able to buy that house, but they can give you an overview of what you can afford. They, by being pre-approved, you've eliminated certain houses from the market. You know, you might want to live in a mansion, but you can only afford, you might want a large home, but you can only afford a smaller home. So you'll limit what you can choose. The banks do give you good ideas to pre-approval. On the other hand, if you talk to a realtor, you can find areas that you can live in easier than if you go to anyone else. Most realtors are aware of what you can afford. If they don't sell you the top house this time, you have had a good experience with them. Maybe you're going to buy a bigger home in 5 to 10 years, and so that doesn't bother them, the price of the home. Get a realtor that you're comfortable with.
We probably ought to talk about what a realtor is. Realtor is actually a trademark term for real estate sales agents who are members of a particular trade group.
Right.
There are brokers, people who run the real estate agencies. There has to be a broker in charge. That's a special license, and they have to have a certain amount of experience. And then they have working with them, not for them, because realtors are not typically, or real estate sales agents, are not typically employees. They're contract workers.
Yes.
And the real estate sales agents are the ones typically who will show you the house, who will show you the various neighborhoods to help you find something. The money that is paid at closing as a realtor's fee is actually a broker's fee, and the broker and the real estate agent share the fee. And fees are negotiable, but in any particular area, they are typically, I guess these days, about 5 yes. or 6% of the sales price.
Most generally, they're around 6%, but they can be flexible. And as I was explaining to you a little bit earlier, you have co-brokers and dual representation sometimes. Sometimes you will have one broker who will list, one person who will be your broker who will help you purchase. So you'll have two brokers involved in sometimes the same transaction. It's called co-broking. Sometimes you'll have a dual responsibility where the person who lists the house also sells it to you. then they generally have conflicts of interest because they have to disclose, make certain disclosures to you as a broker and as a selling agent and also as a purchasing agent.
We're talking about buying a house. My guest is attorney Stephen A. Wicklund. I'm Dan Ringer, and this is The Law Works. Being a dual agent, representing both the buyer and the seller, is legal in West Virginia. We have specific laws authorizing them, but it has to be an acknowledgement by both parties in writing. And I am very nervous when I see that in a real estate transaction.
Generally speaking, if your realtor is not speaking up for you, your bank will. And between the bank and the realtor, you generally get a fairly fair transaction. You will find, though, that when problems develop in a dual agency, you have to go outside that agency to get representation. Either a lawyer who was not involved in the closing will represent you, or usually it's a lawyer who was not involved in that transaction who will represent you if there is an issue, because the dual representation means that they can't side with you if there are issues.
One of the things that will now get me in trouble with real estate brokers and real estate sales agents is this. When somebody comes to me and says, I want to buy a house, I'm looking for a house, who should I contact? And I'll say, drive through the neighborhood, see a house that you find attractive, look at the sign in the front yard. It will say, for sale by such and so a broker, and then there'll be a name at the bottom of that with a phone number. Don't call that person. That's the person who has listed the house for sale. They represent the seller. And most folks are going to get mad at me because mm-hmm. they want to represent both the buyer and the seller right. because they get the entire commission that way. Mm-hmm. The problem is, as Steve pointed out, you need someone to stand up for you specifically. It can be another real estate sales agent. Sometimes they're referred to as a buyer's agent.
Right.
Or it can be your lawyer. And in simple terms, real estate agents on your side are cheaper than having to hire a lawyer to be on your side.
Yes.
May not be as effective overall, but may be good enough.
And honestly, most realtors can work together because co-broking is so common, it's done without too much friction. And they can generally work it out because of communications are fairly good between the realtors. And but the commissions are fairly enticing, and so that gets everyone to work a little bit together. You have to be flexible, though, whenever you're looking at any kind of a sales transaction.
It's probably not a bad idea if you're looking to buy a house to talk to the bank about who the attorney is that's going to be involved. How does that work in practice?
Most banks have an approved list of attorneys, and those are people who are experienced in the transaction. The attorney, because he represents the bank, does not represent you as a purchaser, and it does not represent you as a seller. So you have to realize that they're really representing the bank's interest, and their biggest responsibility is to make sure that the loans are properly executed and that the title is clear. They won't concern themselves with a lot of the problems and the issues if you're not really aware of them.
Oftentimes, when you're a purchaser of a house, your interests and the bank interests are pretty much the same interests. The bank wants to make sure the house is worth what they're loaning you to buy it for, and you want to make sure that the house is worth what you're paying for it. The difference is you're going to be making a down payment, an earnest money deposit. You're putting some money into the purchase of the house. You may only have to put 5% in some cases. In other cases, you may have to put 30% in. The bank's interest is the amount of money they're loaning. Your interest is the amount of the loan and the other money that you paid.
Right.
In the olden days, banks would make sure that there were inspections done on the house and appraisals that supported the value of the house. Not so much these days.
The appraisal has most of the information you want, and they do list the areas. Most appraisals go by the areas. If there are problems with the area, if it's a good area or it's a bad area, they look to the appraisals.
Now you have to talking about the geographic area?
Yes.
Okay.
And it will look at the systems in the house, you know, but you need to test septic. Is expensive if you need it. Heating is expensive. It has to be replaced. The roof, if it doesn't have a good at least 5-year life, you're going to look at some expense. Mentioned that with septic tanks, you generally have more problems with a house that's been vacant for some time than with a house that's occupied and has furniture in it. The house has been vacant because someone has moved, someone has died because of a foreclosure, and generally even the septic tanks aren't always operational, and you have to escrow for a septic tank because a septic tank has to be used to be effective, used within the last 30 days to be effective. So you have more issues when the house is vacant than when it's occupied. But you've got to make sure that all those systems are working. The realtor will give you a good checklist. But you have to make sure, the realtor, the appraiser will give you a good checklist as to what those systems are like and what the areas are like. And if the appraisal does not come in at the price you're paying, you need to renegotiate the price. Every contract should be subject to an appraisal.
An appraisal is performed by a certified, licensed real estate appraiser. They look at the conditions in the neighborhood, they look at the physical condition of the house, and they form an informed opinion.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
About what the house should be worth, what it should sell for on the open market. Now, they can't guarantee that if they think a house is worth $10, it's actually going to sell for $10.
Right.
Market pressures decide what it is. In fact, we technically say anything being bought and sold is worth what the seller is willing to accept and what the buyer is willing to pay. So
if you're smart, you buy low and sell high, but it doesn't always work that way.
And it's tricky to do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But once you get the appraisal, you have at least some idea as to what an expert thinks that house is worth, and banks rely on that in loaning money.
The appraisals were condemned a few years back when the bank got into trouble in 2008, and appraisals now have been a little bit more independent than they were before 2008. There was a time that the federal government shut their eyes because house prices were increasing so rapidly that they didn't look at the appraisals, but now they're looking at appraisals a lot closer.
I actually had a real estate appraiser that I contacted one time to perform an appraisal say to me, "What do you want this house to appraise for?" I said, "I'm sorry, I can't use you. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell me what you think it's worth. I don't want you to work to my price point. You tell me what it's worth, and we'll go from there." And in fact, a few years ago, there were some allegations of collusion between appraisers and banks and real estate agents and
right.
things like
mm-hmm.
that. That was before the housing bust in, about 2008?
The appraisals are pretty careful today. They were sloppy for a long time, but they're much more careful today.
Well, we've been talking about all these requirements and things that are a good idea to do. You have to put all this stuff in writing.
Mm-hmm. It's called a sales contract. Generally speaking, whenever you enter into purchase a home, you need to have a contract with the purchaser that you're going to be buying it. The sales contract, there are forms that most realtors have that are fairly standard, but they have blank spots, and you want to be careful what's in those blank spots. First thing you want to make sure is that there's a price, and even in a realtor's contract, you may make an offer of $100,000 and the seller wants to sell it for $110,000, and you have to cross out and put in a price of $105,000 to come to something in the center.
You negotiate it.
Negotiate, but the contracts sometimes have those marks in them showing the negotiation. They still hold up.
We're talking about buying a house. My guest is attorney Stephen Wicklin. I'm Dan Ringer, and this is The Law Works. And there are lots of other things to put in there, too. If you want to have inspections done, and you do want to have inspections done,
yes,
you have to put that in the contract.
Generally, you want to have it subject to a home inspection by someone who is qualified that you trust to do that home inspection, who will look at the systems of the house. You want to make it subject to an appraisal. You might put a price on there that you think is fair, but the appraisal may come back too low, and you have to lower the price. Generally speaking, if you get a bargain, you never raise the price, but if you are losing money, you generally have to lower the price, at least for the bank standpoint.
As a practical matter, you can't get enough. You can't borrow enough right. money to pay for the house.
It's always subject to bank financing also, and it's subject to pest inspection. And there's words in there such as clear title or title report, and sometimes that's where the attorney will come in and clear the title, make sure all the liens are taken care of and the taxes are paid. You also want to put in there the personal property that you're wanting to sell with a house. Most houses, if anything that's attached, stays, such as curtains and draperies, although sometimes those are accepted. Sometimes the kitchen appliances, such as the oven and the refrigerator and the washer and dryer, sometimes those are easier to purchase than to move in and out. So some personal property always is negotiable, and most people are generally flexible about the personal property today.
We've said many times here on The Law Works that the best way to avoid legal problems is for the parties to talk to each other, to have good communications. In real estate transactions, you've got actually several channels of communications. There's the communications between the buyer and their bank. There's communications between the buyer and their real estate agent and the seller and their real estate agent, and then between the real estate agents and sometimes right. between the brokers that they work with. And there's communications between the sellers and the buyers. And the best real estate transactions I've ever seen were ones where the sellers and the buyers were talking between themselves freely.
Yes.
And then keeping other people advised as to what was going on.
And you'll have closings where people have not met until a closing, and they get along fine. And you'll have other closings where people are distant, especially in situations where maybe the couple is separating or the sellers are not on the same wavelength. Every closing is a little bit different, but you'll have certain closings that are more distant than others, and those are not good, but sometimes it's that you can work through those.
And even in the most open, most conversant, most friendly transactions, things can go wrong that people just don't know about. We talk about having inspections. I bought the 100-year-old house some years ago, and for inspections, I hired a structural engineer, a real licensed engineer, to go through the house and look at it. I had an electrician, I had an HVAC person looking at it, I had a mason, a stonemason, in to look at the foundations and the walls around the house, and I had a owner of a building supply company come with me because he was kind of my catch-all guy. He knew what all this old stuff was. Within 6 months, I was replacing the roof on the house and shortly thereafter, the water heater. You just can't catch everything.
If you have bad vibes, sometimes you better listen to your vibes. Generally speaking, though, with an older house, you expect those kind of things and you're not shocked. What's bad is when the new house has structural problems and there's no one to give you any relief. The bank will clean their hands, the realtor will clean their hands, the attorney will tell you how expensive it is to litigate a new house case, and you'll have a couple years in court if there's problems. Most of the litigation over houses has to do with foundation issues, which were not readily apparent, structural deep problems that were not apparent until after you bought the house, that these were lacking. And sometimes these are very serious, especially in new housing construction areas.
I have met a number of people who said they had a new house built. That was the way they went. They didn't want to buy an old house. They want to buy a used house, if that's different. They want to have a new house built. I have never met anyone who said, I want to build a second house.
Right.
It is so stressful.
Stressful. In West Virginia, most of our lots that are available are not flat. And you generally have to consider the foundation issues that go with a hill. Anyone who is not experienced with hillside problems realizes that there are some serious problems. But outside of the foundation problems, in a house you have to choose everything from carpeting to walls to fixtures, and it's stressful. But I did it 35 years ago and I have no regrets now.
You going to do it again?
No. No.
And that's
my retirement home will not be built by me.
And oftentimes people will find a new subdivision. That would be an area in which a lot of new houses are being built, typically by the same contractor or by the same group of people. And there are problems with those that are not always readily apparent. Typical among those problems is the movement of water around the property. When you start paving roads, building houses, you change the water flow. And sometimes it can be changed disastrously.
Sometimes it affects you and sometimes you affect someone else. Now the water flow problems and the litigation over water flow, you generally live in the house even though it's been damaged and the suit may take 2 or 3 years and you just sort of are stuck in the middle of that house, either a buyer or a seller, without being able to move the house.
And when you get into a situation like that, it's impossible to sell the house, too.
Because of the mold issues.
Well, because it's in litigation.
Right.
And there are complaints about maybe the way it was constructed, maybe the way the water's flowing, or you're being sued. It's just really, really complex. House buying is not easy, and it's not for the uninformed.
Most of the new subdivisions also have what they call restrictive covenants or conditions or homeowners associations that there are restrictive covenants in deeds, but most of the subdivisions will have their subdivision ordinances, architectural control committees, or that nature, which will try to set forth standards. If that group is independent of the builder, you don't have as many problems as if the builder controls that group.
But sometimes that group is referred to as the homeowner's Gestapo.
Yes.
Because they can tell you the color you're going to paint your house, what you're going to have in the front yard, what your mailbox is going to look like.
Sometimes, but generally speaking, if you get along with your neighbors and you don't ruffle any feathers, you get along fine.
I suppose the closing line, Steve, is be careful, be very careful, know what you're doing, and find a lawyer to talk to. Steve Wicklund, thank you very much, Steve, for being with us. Thank you also for being with us. On behalf of the Law Works, I'm Dan Ringer. Good evening.
If you would like to suggest a topic for a future The Law Works show, or if you're a school teacher and would like to receive a DVD of this show for classroom use, send us an email to thelawworks@comcast.net or visit us on Facebook. On the Law Works website at thelawworks.org, you'll find a listing of recent The Law Works programs, additional information about this show's topic, and video of this and recent shows. You can also find the Law Works programs on YouTube and iTunes.
The Law Works is produced in cooperation with the Office of the West Virginia Attorney General, the West Virginia Bar Foundation, the Mountain State Bar, the Monongalia County Bar Association, and the West Virginia University College of Law. The Law Works is made possible by major grants from the Office of the West Virginia Attorney General and from Software Systems Incorporated, a West Virginia company established in 1975, which provides high-end support services, programming, and consulting for county government AS400 mid-range computer systems, as well as PC-based systems, and by a grant from the West Virginia Bar Foundation. The West Virginia Bar Foundation, the philanthropic organization for West Virginia's legal profession and justice system, promoting public knowledge of the law in West Virginia. Additional support for the Law Works is provided by the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals.
From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.